Then welcome to this next lecture on virtual machines. So we are rapidly coming to an end of this semester, and this means we are now entering the last block, the last subject of this lecture, namely threads. And you may recall that this is a 3 hours lecture and not a 4 hours lecture, and we have kind of taken the liberty to lecture with two lectures a week, and by that we have made good progress. And now this the last topic covers 3 lectures, which so then we have 2 possibilities. Either we slow down and have 1 lecture a week. This gives 3 more weeks. Or if you prefer, we could kind of continue with 2 lectures a week and then would be ready with a lecture in the mid of next week. So I don't know what is preferable to you. The second. So being yet now quick and then quitting early. Okay, so then we will do it like that. So then that means we will have a lecture today, tomorrow, and next Monday, essentially. Okay, so last week I was away with there we have what they call in English a research training group of the DFG, Graduiertenkolleg, and there was a meeting in Darkstuhl of all these research training groups, and so I had to be there. So I apologize for not having been here, but I think Michael Petter, who is an expert in object-oriented programming, and hopefully he gave you, gave you a very detailed idea of what's going on with object-oriented programming and how you can translate it into some kind of virtual machines. And I think looking at the slides he presented, he not only showed how to implement like C++ by means of an extension of the C machine, but he also gave you a glimpse on how the LLVM deals with inheritance and even with multiple inheritance, which is a notoriously complicated thing. Okay, so that now leaves us with threads alone. So threads is a very important subject. Well, every subject is very important. It would not be part of the lecture. But why are threads so important? In essence, they are so important for since modern architectures are concurrent, provide multiple cores, multiple processors, and since the we cannot not hope that in future technological development will speed up, will lead to an increase in individual processor speed. So all the speed up which we in the long run can hope for is by means of concurrency. And so therefore programming languages have to support some kind of notion of multi-threading. And so these notions of multi-threading are more or less deeply integrated into the language, typically less deeply integrated. So, for example, OCaml does not provide any true concurrency in some sense. They only provide a concurrency by means of a library, which in the end does not lead to true concurrency in that sense, that you occupy multiple cores, but kind of a in-processor concurrency in that multiple threads share the same virtual machine. And that is perhaps a little bit different with Java. Java provides, there was in the old days, a version of the virtual machine which also provided this onboard concurrency. Without which does not speed up your program, but only gives you the illusion of having multiple threads. But modern Java implementations provide really multiple threads, so that means you can flood your system with independent threads, if you like. And so there is some kind of deep embedding, if you like, of concurrency into Java. It is for C++, there was for a long time no real support for concurrency, only something like pthreads. So these were extra libraries where by low level primitives allowed to provide concurrency. And I think in the new C++ standard they have a better integration of threads into the language. But I think it's still based on pthreads, or are there many more primitives? So here what we will do, we will take a minimalistic point of view. We will kind of we do not want to invent a new language here, and we want to concentrate here on the concurrence, on implementing the concurrency primitives. So therefore, we would like to build on an existing language, and so we start out from C and put some threads in it. And this thread package is a little bit idealized. It's not like pthreads, but more or less similar to pthreads. The pthread commands which we use here are more complicated than these ones, so it's a kind of simplified versions of these. For example, if I recall correctly, when you create a new thread in pthreads, you have to specify also the size of a block which this process may consume as stack space. And that is a little bit weird and difficult to handle, and so therefore we do not. So these kind of components we skip. And also you can kind of specify things like priorities or so, which we also ignore completely. Okay, and also, so now the other thing is that how do our considerations here are based on a virtual machine, and now our virtual machine is necessarily sequential. So, or at least it has been sequential, and the question is how could a concurrent or parallel virtual machine look like? And that is not completely obvious, so therefore we, for simplicity, stay with a virtual, an implementation of concurrency in the style of this OCaml concurrency, that is one virtual machine executed by a sequential processor simulating multiple threads. So then you might now say, why should one have such a thing? Why multiple threads then at all if everything is simulated by a single processor? Is there a reason why one still would like, perhaps, to have multiple threads, even if one has only a single processor to execute them? Yes. So the program we envision might want to have it responsive to certain events which may come at any time. And so this can be done in some sense. Also, at least in my perspective, the starting point for the multi-threading in Java at that time was not so much to speed up programs, but more to get to have a nice user interface which can react on multiple events simultaneously without blocking the user interface. So that was kind of the one key reason for having such kind of concurrency. And clearly, the other one is to speed up. But that is kind of simply a second application of threads. Okay. So now, what is kind of so that was kind of the general introduction, or what kind of concepts we would like to. We want to have multiple threads. So what kind of, if you like, API do we need for it? So clearly we need something for creating and terminating threads. Then we also, what else do we need? So, well, that's in some sense, one could say that's enough, because then But that's not true, because typically threads have to communicate with each other, and then they have to synchronize in some way. And the question is, what is a minimalistic set of synchronization primitives which one would like to have? So that is one perhaps very simple thing. So you have spawned a thread, and that has run, and you just want to continue with your main thread only after a particular thread has terminated. And this is this joining thing. So that these things, in some sense, if you like this, do also exist in Java. The joining is called joining. The creation is not called creation, but it's you initialize a thread object, and then you start it. And that is kind of two things which kind of are separate. First you create an object, and then you and by that this thread is not yet running. And then the start method then kind of calls the run method, and then something is running. So the creation here in this pthread style is different. The creation receives just a function and an argument, and then the function is applied to the argument, and that's the thread. So that's kind of a non-object-oriented way of dealing with threads. Okay, so that was the joining, but then as there are other things which might want to have, that is this locking and unlocking. And that is kind of, this is the thing with, you do not want a thread just waiting for a thread to terminate, but you want to protect a certain critical section. And for that, it's a very old concept to have this locking and unlocking. But there are some more concepts like this, like in Java, this waiting and notifying. So this is kind of a wait and signal, for example. So that is another concept which is useful, and we will look at that. Interestingly, there are also the pthread mechanism and the Java mechanism is a little bit different. So you can only, if you have an object, then and lock for it, then you can wait at that object. But in pthreads, the things are locking and waiting is kind of made two separate concepts. There's this notion of a condition variable. Who has heard of these condition variables ever? So perhaps you did a little bit of pthread, did you a little bit of pthread programming? So then you know. And in some sense, in Java, one could think that an object has a lock and a condition variable built in. While in pthreads, you have locks and you have condition variables, and typically you then might kind of do the correlation of condition variables and locks on your own. So typically you have to use a particular lock together with a condition variable, but it is your choice how to do this correspondence. Okay, so but we will see examples for that and try then to translate it. Okay, so now that's kind of the API which we want to realize, and so we concentrate on these operations only, and that means we just take a virtual machine which we have and see what we do have to modify it. So clearly, we would like we have our separate store for the code, the C. And the PC, which points to the next instruction to be executed, and we have a heap. And now, for convenience, we put the heap into a separate data structure. It is kind of the same address space as the stacks. That is because it's C, but we kind of think of it as somehow in a separate segment or in the second portion of the the memory. So we do not want to kind of think about the clashes between stacks and heaps. So we ignore that for a moment and assume that this never happens. Or if it happens, then the segmentation fault at runtime will happen anyway, and so we will not care about it. So that's this thing, and so these are kind of, in some sense, well-known data structures which we have seen. Oops. More interesting thing is this data structure. So the overall storage S then is separated into, so contains now several data structures. So on the first thing, so that the heap we have seen, so here is a heap inside some segment inside the store, but then we have multiple stacks. And multiple stacks because we might have multiple threads and each thread has its own stack. And then we have the stack pointer and the frame pointer which point to the current, they refer to one of these stacks inside the store. Okay. So clearly we could, once again, I said that already, we could kind of assume if there were no, the heap could not contain pointers to the stack, or we could not kind of do some address calculation to refer to perhaps you could think of storing a number somewhere in the heap, and then you make some fancy calculation, some cast and so on, and then you have a stack pointer. So things like that could be possible in C and would be perfectly legal, and therefore we cannot kind of make the heap a separate data structure from the stacks. So we have to use a uniform address space, which is a little bit old-fashioned and insecure, but this is how C works. And so, and therefore, if we could separate it, we could then make use perhaps even a separate segment even for each stack or so, and then kind of number the stacks, but that we cannot do because it's a uniform address space, and in some sense even there could be weird things. Maybe this completely, I don't know what that, you could have kind of such weird pointers. I don't know whether that makes sense. This would probably lead very soon to a programming error, but in principle nobody hinders you to do such things. But still, the stack pointer and the frame pointer, they together uniquely identify the stack in some sense where we are currently working on. Yeah, and that I have already told you, so we will omit this extreme pointer. What would the extreme pointer be? It's not so clear here anymore what the extreme pointer would mean, because it is not only that the heap might not clash with the stacks, but also one stack might have a clash with another stack. And so in that sense, you might need extreme pointers between each of these stacks, and this would be very weird. And how this set or this sequence of stacks could be implemented at all, this we might wonder later, or come up with some data structure for that later on anyway. Okay, so that is kind of the current setting. And then the, now how this, so this is the, if you like, the data structure for the individual threads. This does not help us how to schedule the threads and how to maintain the threads. And so the main, the key issue which we would like to have is the reticule. So what is the reticule? The reticule is a data structure containing every thread, all the threads which might currently run. Now the question is, how do we identify threads that may currently run? And that we can, for that we need something like a thread ID. Thread ID. So in POSIX threads, thread ID is a separate data type, and which is, the question is, how does one implement this data type? So here, for simplicity, we assume these thread IDs, a thread ID is just a number. And now, what is this number good for? So this number should kind of, so it identifies the thread. But now there, one thread might be running, many threads might be possibly running, but currently not running. And so we have to kind of store information about these threads somewhere. And for that, I suggest that one would have a thread table. That thread table is indexed by the thread IDs. And it contains all the kind of, if you like, a working set, so the relevant information to run this thread, the thread. So if I say thread 5 should run, then I may look up in the thread table what information I have about thread 5, and then I can initialize my registers and continue with the operation of thread 5. Yeah? So that is the thread table, and And once again, at every point in time, there could be several such executable running, possibly running tasks. There's only one thread which may currently run in the current virtual machine. And this is held now. How can we deal with that? Well, for that we have a dedicated, or I suggest that we have a special register, the current thread register. And that kind of contains the thread ID of the thread which is currently running. Yeah? And now then it is clear, then there could be then our library or our pthread or thread implementation should allow to access the thread ID of the current thread. And that is now, what does that mean? So this is this function self. This returns a thread ID, so it has no arguments. And, what should it do? It should return the content of the register current CT. Yeah? And that is, we have, so now again, the old, old method. How to deal with a new functionality, which we have not yet an instruction for. So we introduce a new instruction self, implementing this function call self. And what does it? So it takes the content of the register current thread and pushes it on top of the stack. So that's it. Yeah? So very easy. So now we can, so this is, so there is also in Java there's a similar method. I think it's called current thread, and that pushes you the reference to the current thread object, and that is that is this. I think it's the current thread object. Yeah. And here we have a number. Okay. So the remaining executable threads, which could which are ready, meaning that they could possibly run. They are kept in a special data structure, this ready queue, and actually their thread IDs are kept in this ready queue. And now this queue, somewhere we have to implement, so now this is a runtime function, runtime data structure, which we have to provide, like the thread table, and that we must implement somehow in our virtual machine. And so for this day, so we know how to implement queues. So here, so therefore it suffices to specify kind of the interface for this data structure. So the first thing is this enqueuing, and the other thing is the dequeuing. So enqueuing should allow us to add a thread, a new thread ID, to insert a new thread ID into the queue, and dequeue should allow us to extract one or the next thread ID out of the queue. And a queue, well, should suggest you that there is kind of an ordering in which the threads inside the queue are maintained. So in this sense, we add at the end and extract at the beginning. So this is kind of a FIFO, first in, first out principle, and that is in some sense important. Why? Yes, it's kind of a question of fairness, so that whenever you have been entered into the, you have become ready, then the user expects that this thread former or later will run. And if we do not use the FIFO principle, but the LIFO principle, for example, last in, first out, this means it's something which is deep, could at the bottom, so to speak, so it waits while other threads are entered and executed and entered and executed, and you wait forever. And that is kind of cannot happen if you use really a queue, because then things are extracted on the top, but then your priority in some sense rises and rises and rises until you sit on the at the front, and then you are extracted. For that, still starvation is not completely Yes. So there's still kind of this problem that there's only one thread ahead of you, but this thread simply does not give in and continues to run forever. Then we are still have some kind of problem. For that, we kind of there are several solutions to it. One solution is we rely on the operating system or the virtual machine to deal with it. And the other solution is that we expect every thread to be friendly and yield now and then. That is kind of give up and requeue, so to speak. So I guess we will come to that. So for the moment, we just take this this queuing thing as the best. So that one might still add one more information or one more little bit of discussion here. That is, if threads have priority, so if we did not, I explicitly ruled it out, but in reality people like to have priorities for their threads, then you could kind of exchange this data structure of a queue into a priority queue. That kind of, by that you could kind of you do not kind of queue in the end, but you queue somewhere else according to your priority. But I would say to my personal taste, it is already difficult enough to get a concurrent system running in a meaningful way. And adding priorities makes things in life not easier, but more complicated and intricate, and introduces new features and makes life harder. And I do not recommend to implement systems where the correctness depends on the priorities of the threads. So I don't know whoever has implemented a system where priorities really matter. I actually met no one, but maybe you have more experience with that. Then please tell me. So actually, sometimes we see industrial code, and there people make heavy use of priorities, but it's also not clear to me whether they really understand what they are doing there. Okay, so here is now my thread table. So the thread table, as I said, contains is indexed by the thread IDs, and so there is this current thread register points somewhere into this table, and then there is this ready queue, which also contains thread IDs, which somehow point into this table. And in the table, there should be all relevant information for running the thread. So enqueue, if we have this situation and we enqueue 13, then this should mean that this 13 is added at the end. So that is what we would expect. And if we dequeue something and put it into the current thread thing, then we would kind of take out when this was the end. Then this is the beginning, and then this should kind of move over here. Yeah. So we do not try to be fancy here, but we try to be, again, as always, as simplistic as possible, and that in some sense this is important to have this very rapid. This low overhead change between threads. So if you encourage people to use multi-threading and thread context switch between threads is expensive, then kind of this is not a kind of useful style. But if threads are very lightweight, like here, where switching, it's just kind of, you kind of exchange a number in a register and then a different thread is running, in principle. Additionally, you have to reinstall the remaining working set, if you like. But this is currently for C, or in this setting, it's just three registers, namely the PC. You have to know where the what's the next instruction in this thread. You have to and the SP and the FP, this signifies the stack where you have to compute. So in this sense, so it's not just putting another number into the current thread register, but you also have to do then a lookup in the thread table, fetch these three registers, and update the three registers. But still, this is comparatively cheap. In the virtual machine. In real life, things are then more complicated. Why are things then more complicated also? Because then the cache is full of data from another thread, so all the next accesses will be cache misses, and so in that sense, then you are punished furthermore. And also real processors have more registers, not just these four. And so therefore, if you have to save all the registers and restore them, if it's 32, then it's more expensive. Yes?
I think that the modern processors, they have shadow registers. So they have two sets of registers which they can swap immediately without one instruction or so.
Yeah, that's cool, but does not help you with hundreds of threads. This helps you for a context switch between two or three, something like that. So there are tricks to make it better. I think this kind of shallow registers might help, for example, to implement things like leaf procedures, where you have kind of a procedure and a procedure call, but that is only and that is not recursive. So then that means the old registers do not have to be saved onto the stack, but can be kept there. Then you do have your registers for the kind of intermediate programming execution, and then you throw them away and get the others in a finger snip back. And that's and these leaf procedures are very, very frequent. So in that sense, this is a very good thing for this thing. Yeah.
But I have another question. Regarding the different threads you had mentioned in
The same what? Well,
the same. Well, the same memory.
Yeah, the same memory. That's true. For all stacks have to live in the same memory. So it's kind of problematic if the stack space is unknown, the amount of stack space which each thread consumes. So therefore, I think pthread demands the programmer to give bounds to this stack space.
I think in pthread, it is limited by the operating system. There's kind of like how many threads you can create. But the question is there a possibility currently in use which protects the individual space of the stack of the individual threads? Because,
So the question is whether there's a way that how to realize multiple stacks without caring that one stack hits the other, and we will see later there is a possibility to do so. So one can, it's kind of an, you need kind of a data structure for it, and in some sense, yeah, but it's there is a possibility to do so. Yes. So, and I think so. There's a very quick answer. You could kind of implement. You can always implement the stack inside the heap. You can always say that a stack frame is a fresh memory block, and it contains a pointer to another memory block, namely the predecessor stack frame. And if you have multiple threads, then this means you have multiple of these stack frames sitting around with these pointers to their predecessor pointers. And so the stack space, only the total amount of stack space should not grow too large. But so there is no conflicts of individual stacks. So this one could always have. But maybe some, so we will see later a little bit simpler, which is not perhaps as expensive as this one. Yeah. Okay. So now, here for the moment we kind of say, in the simple world of our virtual machine, we only have these very few registers to save and to restore. That is, if a thread is interrupted, so it is thrown out of the running, then this means we need, for that, we kind of provide a function save, which then saves the current values of these three registers. And this save function has no argument. So why? Because it considers, it saves the registers of the current thread. Yeah, so it takes the CT register and saves for that thread, saves a frame pointer PC and SP, and it saves them into the thread table where there is memory for it. Yeah, so that is, in this sense, it is very simple. So it's save we may call to store, to rescue the current thread. And then there is a restore thing, and that is kind of analogous. So this again has no argument. It assumes that the current thread ID has already been set to the next running thread, and then restore will fetch the corresponding values from the thread table and put them into the registers. Yeah. So with these two things, we can do this context switch. Okay, and then I said also a few minutes ago, I said, okay, if we don't have, if we assume that, so our scheduling by means of a queue itself does not guarantee fairness, but either we interrupt threads or we provide a thread may call something like a function yield, which gives up which voluntarily kind of reschedules the current thread. And that is how would one... it is perhaps convenient to provide an instruction yield, which does such a context switch. So what does it do? It tries to enqueue the current thread into the ready queue and replace the current thread by something in the ready queue. So therefore, the whole thing starts with extracting something out of this ready queue. Now it could be that this ready queue is empty. In this case, nothing should happen, because then yield, there is nothing, no other thread which we could make running. So then nothing should happen. If you assume that a DQ of an empty queue returns minus one, for example, DQing an empty queue returns minus one, then we may test, check for availability of another thread by checking this CT value against zero. So if it's at least zero, then there was something in the queue, and then this one should run next. So in order to do so, we first save the current thread, then we enqueue the current thread into the queue, and then we put the value which we have extracted out of the queue into the current thread register, and then we restore this thread, and then we continue. Okay? So here we have made we found it very useful to have these macros or this runtime function save and restore, which do this context switching for us. Okay, so that now we have an instruction yield for our convenience, which we could either place by the compiler or let it be called manually from some thread. Okay, so now let us take a little bit closer this fairness thing to achieve fairness between threads. Okay, so our goal is that every thread, former or later, should be scheduled for running. Every thread which is possibly running should be former or later be allowed to run. And that means that every thread must former or later be either ready, be completed, or be interrupted. And so I said, one thing is we provide this function yield, which the the programmer can simply call. Or another possibility is that we put the burden onto the code generation and the virtual machine. So that let us now concentrate on that. And so there is now the question: how should we build our virtual machine? So one possibility is that after every instruction, we insert this super duper new instruction yield, which achieves a context switch after every instruction. So that would be a kind of optimal, because then really every thread executes a real instruction and then a context switch and then so on and so on. But that is obviously way too expensive, because that means that every instruction, for every instruction we have the overhead of, I don't know, at least 6, 7, 8 instructions. Because this saving is 3 instructions, restoring is 3 instructions, and in between this dequeuing, so it's a lot. So this slows down the whole thing by a factor of 10 or so. So that is something which we definitely do not want to achieve. So from a theoretical point of view, this is only a constant factor, but from a practical point of view, this is kills the whole thing. So, but that also indicates if the overhead is kind of 10, then this means that if we kind of only have to insert this yield instruction, say every 10 instructions, then the thing is, then we only slow down the whole machine by a factor of 2. And so that becomes a little bit more realistic. So it means actually if we could insert this yield instruction even not only after every 10 instructions, but even fewer places, then the slowdown is again goes down and down. So the goal is to put it in as few places as possible. So clearly we can put it every 100 instructions, but that is kind of no solution because so if you statically do that every 100 instructions, then there could be a small loop with less than 100 instructions, which we miss and where a thread runs forever. So we have not really solved the problem. So every 100 instructions statically in the code is not a good idea. Then there could, the other opportunity, the other choice might be that we have a counter. And that counter, well, if there's a counter, we could let it count not to 100, we could also let it count to 1,000, perhaps, yeah, to get the very small overhead and do the yielding only every 1,000 instructions. But then we have this overhead of implementing the counter. And that is also not completely for free, because if for every instruction we have to increment the counter, then we might not so be happy. So that is also all these choices are not so I would say satisfactory. So one would like to look for other things. So the other thing is we could kind of just insert these context switches at not kind of crudely every 10 instructions, but at particular situations in the code. And then we might wonder what are the minimal amount of places where we should place a yield so that every infinite computation necessarily will have a yield, will hit a yield form or later. So that is now kind of, now we have to think how a program can run forever. And one possibility is so that there's a loop. Now, if there's a loop, how can we identify? So, where would we place? So, that is one thing. So, we could kind of, if we jump back to the beginning, so at these jumps back, at these places, we could kind of put a yield. So this means if we jump forward in forward direction, like for an if then else, then we would not yield. But if we jump back, like in a while loop, then we would kind of insert the yield. So that would be one possibility. There's another chance for infinite computation, that is for through procedure calls or function calls, and therefore, so there we could also kind of try to identify strongly connected components in functions. But and things like that in function call graphs and so on, this might be possible, but is more efforts for that we need more pre-computation. One simple choice would be that we kind of say a function at the beginning of a function body, we place a yield. So before a function is called, we first yield. That is kind of, if you have many very small functions, then this is still not a very good idea and causes a significant slowdown. But you might imagine that your compiler does inlining anyway. So these very small functions typically will already have been inlined by the compiler. So that means for code generation, they are no longer there. And then it is so the function bodies are larger and not so very small, and that means this is not so bad a strategy to place them at the beginning of these calls. Yeah. So by this is perhaps a simple strategy. So we do not need a counter and can hope that the yielding will not occur too often. Okay. And then there is also other things like now even inside the loops, one might wonder, you have a small loop which only iterates for three times or so, and then there is this stupid context switch inside. But then there are other compiler optimizations which are applied by compilers, which is, for example, this loop unrolling business. And typically, GCC and also the LLVM are very good at that. So if the compiler has an idea how often a loop is iterated, then the loop goes away immediately. And in that sense, there would also be no context switch there. Okay. And, now then, there is the one, so this jumping back, we might identify in the code and place a context switch there, but then there are other things where other jump instructions which could be used by a malicious programmer to produce loops and without a context switch, like this jump, this index jump, or this jump at zero if used in a freely programmed style. So, because if somebody directly writes the assembly code, then you have no chance to do anything. But then, if it's freely programmed, then one could also say, then there is all responsibility lies on the programmer, and the compiler need not give a damn about it. Yeah. Okay. And even even if that is we find that too expensive, we could still combine that with the other dynamic things. So that means if we have a loop and we find we have a yield inside it, then we could have for this loop also or the yield itself contains a counter and only does the context switch every 100 iterations. That would even more reduce the number of switches, and by that we can adjust the overhead of the context switch against the number of occurrences of switches. Yes, but that, in some sense, that means how do we kind of trigger the interrupt? So there must be some kind of counter or clock which can of the machine which can be read. And so we can do it and hope that the implementation will be extremely fast. Yes, we can do that. So in particular, if you think of that the virtual machine is only one process in the operating system, then that operating system may use other cores or other things to kind of read the timer also. Yes. So all these things could also be used instead. So here is kind of minimalistic. What can we do if we only rely on the virtual machine? But we could use simply don't bother about it and delegate it all into the assume that the implementation of the yield is smart. So that was the ultimate discussion on this fairness thing. So I find that a little bit interesting because that in that sense at least, so that we kind of also, we only look statically at the code. I can identify a small subset of places where to insert the yield, and we do not have to rely on counters. But we can combine that. Okay. So now comes. So that was This now comes the first major issue, namely we have one thread running, and at some point we want to have more threads, and for that we promised that there is something like a function create, which creates a new thread. And so this create function has two arguments, we take only two arguments from those which are provided by the related function in the pthreads library. And the first one is should be a function pointer or a function, and the second one an argument. And so how can we kind of end an arbitrary argue? So this create is in some sense, so if this were a functional programming language, then one would have a nice polymorphic type system, and then functions and data would all be only references, and so we need not care. But in C, it's a little bit more problematic. So a function pointer, okay, so this is an address, so this is, we know how it's one memory cell or 4 bytes or so, but how can we supply this function with a generic argument? And should be the type of this argument? So what is the general C solution for that? A void pointer, which is a little bit weird. So it's a pointer to nothing, so to speak. And that can then be cast to other pointers. So then later you have to cast it to some real thing and hope that the cast is does the right thing. And then you have a pointer to a type, and that means that the function also should take have an appropriate argument. So you cannot have 5 arguments of the function f, but only 1. Okay, so that by that we provide the function and the argument, and then we assume that the thread which is created will apply f to the argument and execute it. Now this create thing has a return value, and that return value is not the return value of f applied to a, but the return value of the create is the thread ID of the new thread. And this makes sense, because somehow you create a thread and then you want to communicate with it, perhaps, or synchronize with it, and or for example, simply join it, wait until it's done. And so you have to know what kind of thread it is, and that means, and this is therefore create returns the thread ID. And in particular, not only that, this thread creation could also fail, and then we assume that it returns some kind of error code. So here in this case, we assume that it would return -1, and otherwise the thread ID. And so now we have understood the semantics of this create function. Now we have to think about how do we implement it. So how do we implement it? So the first thing clearly is we have to evaluate the arguments. We have to know the function, we have to know the argument. Then we have, so that's one thing. Then we have to allocate a new stack, not only a new stack frame, but a new stack. And on the new stack, we have to provide a stack frame for the application F applied to A. And then we have to generate a new thread ID for the new thread, and then we have to extend this thread table with an entry for the new thread ID. And once we have all done that, so then the new thread can run. Okay, but how can it run? Because currently the thread who has created this one is running. So in that sense, it cannot run, but it can be put into the ready queue. So this means it will run at the next possible opportunity. Okay. So that would be kind of our, if you like, tasks to be implemented. And, there's still some weird typo here. So we would kind of how can we implement it then? So, okay this create is, it is, so C is a call by value language, so therefore we have first to evaluate the arguments. So that means we first evaluate these beasts, and from right to left, so therefore I evaluated them from left to right, but okay, and then we kind of probably we should do it in the opposite order. Probably one should do it in the opposite order, yes. And then there is this, one has to do the initialization thing for which we have virtual machine instruction so far. So therefore I kind of took the liberty to use two of them. So one for initializing the stacks and one for initializing the threads. So the initialization of stacks, what do we have to do there? So the first thing is we have no stack at hand for the new thread, so we have to create a new stack. So this is kind of a runtime function which somehow has to provide us with extend our collection of stacks by a new one. So for example in this way. So this means that now this executing this function new stack on one given stack will extend our set of stacks with one more instance and provide a pointer to the topmost, to the single element in this stack, and push this reference on top of the given stack. And there is always the possibility that the creation of a new stack fails because there's memory exhausted or whatever kind of things might happen, and then there will be null as a return value. Okay, so then, so that was, now what does init stack do? So we are given a stack, and now we want then the first thing which we do is we call this new stack operation. This new stack operation provides us with a pointer to creates a new stack and gives us a pointer to the topmost element of it, which is one element, the bottom element. And so this should be different from zero. So therefore, we have this kind of test here. And if that is the case, then we put on... so what do I do here? The first thing is... In the topmost, the element. This element here, on top of the stack. New stack. Sorry, no. So what did I do here? I'm a little bit confused. SP minus one. So this double this double indirection makes it a little complicated. So here at that place here, this address, this pointer here points to this place, and there I put the what I have on just below. So what I have here, this element, I put in here. Then in this memory, this is the next here in this case. This refers to the initialization of the second memory cell. This I initialize with -1. And then the F, this I put over here. And and then at then I pop the after having placed in this way three elements here into the new stack, I copy the reference S of SP. So I pop the stack, but I slide somehow the topmost element down. But I wonder why it is here not why instead now I have this reference I have placed here in this place, so one step down. And I wonder, and that the picture kind of does not really indicate that. So the code here is not like the picture there. So there's kind of a mismatch between the description here and the picture. But what are these new values which have been put onto the stack? So the first thing, this F beast, the F is the address which should be, this is the continuation address where the where execution should continue when the thread has terminated. So therefore, and there will be a kind of a fixed sequence of a fixed piece of code to be executed when a thread has terminated. And since a running thread just executes a function call and therefore does not know that it is kind of not just a function call but a thread. So therefore the continuation address after when this function application has terminated, continuation address must kind of then cause that the thread itself is terminated and not just the function call. Okay, so that is the one thing, and therefore the second thing is that this -1, what is this -1? So now we see here once again this F here is the continuation address Then in the stack frame, additionally, we need the old frame pointer, and that is, since there is no frame pointer, no old frame pointer here, so therefore this is -1. And the extreme pointer, which is the third organizational cell, this is simply missing because we kind of said we do no longer consider extreme pointers. So that is these two things. And now the only thing which is that here in the bottommost things, or what is, I mean, what did we put there? So now I'm really a little bit confused what I meant by that piece of code. I will try to figure that out and then maybe tell you again. Now the other so that would be So once again, this is at least in philosophically speaking, this in its stack should provide us here with the organization of the organization of the stack frame within which the the thread is evaluated. Now I understand here. And this one down here, this is kind of, sorry for kind of making such a thing. Here is this little value A. This is the argument pointer. Because this is, we have the parameters and then on top of it the organizational cells. And so this should be the A. I'm not so sure whether this here really is implemented by that. SP. Oh yes. So the argument here was the argument. Is this true? The E1. Yes. The E1 is the argument. So that should be. So here is the little a sitting down here. Yeah. In this sense, it is correct. And then here is the frame pointer, and this is the continuation address, which have been placed there, and in the end we have to jump to the function pointer which sits in this memory cell down here. But for the moment we have kind of pushed that, squeezed that out, and then this is gone, and this is has moved one step down. Okay, so that was, so at least this gives an explanation to this piece of code. And now I have not yet told you what this init thread is, and that we will see in a minute. Okay, so this init thread should at least provide us with a new thread ID, now where do we get the new thread ID from? So new thread IDs, in fact, is not so easy, at least if you have a concurrent system, because there could be multiple threads in parallel, and multiple threads in parallel could create new threads. And somehow you need, in order to get a really fresh ID, you need kind of a synchronization mechanism. So a central data structure which generates these thread IDs. In some sense, it's amazing that this creation of thread IDs in some sense leads to a certain sequentialization of code. The same is true with the allocation of memory. If several threads allocate memory, then the question is how can they do it? Because it may cause a conflict to the how to say, an access conflict to the same data structure which provides the new memory blocks. So therefore, if you have a truly multi-threaded system, you must take care of avoiding such bottlenecks. For example, by avoiding a concurrent data structure for the heap management, so that you kind of can have that several threads in parallel may access memory blocks, for example. Now for the thread ID, so in our very simplistic implementation, it is we can deal with this problem more easily since the multiple threads are only virtual. So that means the virtual machine itself can just maintain a counter of all threads which are there, and when a new at one point in time only one thread is created, and just we take this the current thread ID and increment the counter. Yeah, okay. So that is for us. We simply take this counter, a thread counter, to provide new thread IDs. And initially, this thread counter has the value 0, corresponding to the initial thread ID of the initial thread. And so that means if the that the thread counter always counts to has the value of the last thread to which has been created, which means before extracting a new thread ID out of before creating a new thread ID extracting a new thread ID we have to increment it. Okay, so that now here comes the situation which we have. So we have the situation is that is the current thread counter, and on top of the stack we have a reference to some newly created stack, to the topmost element in a newly created stack, and below that we have the function to be called. Yeah, so it's not yet called, but it will be called. And then, and here is the ready queue. And now, so what the thing what we have to do is, so we have to create a new thread ID. So here we have to increment the thread counter. So this value then has to be added inside the ready queue. Then we have to create an entry in the thread table. And in that thread table, we have to place the frame pointer and the stack pointer of the current thread. Okay, so this is twice this value. This we have to place here. And now we also have to place the PC to be executed when the thread is started. And this PC is exactly that thing which is still sitting down here. Okay. So by that, So that would be the initialization of the new thread. And then on top of the stack, we have to return the new thread ID. Yeah, and I hope I have popped the stack accordingly. Yes, I have. So here in this case, I did it right. Okay, so now, so in this sense, here more things happen than in this other situation, but in some sense, now it is comparatively clear what has to be done, and therefore we could easily follow what's going on. Okay, is there a question? So now here's an effort to implement that. So again, only if the if we really succeeded with we really succeeded with creating the new thread, then we increment the thread counter, then we initialize the corresponding entry in the thread table by placing in these two fields the current stack pointer, the content of the on top of the stack, and the PC. This is the element below that value, which contains the address where computation should continue or should start when this thread becomes running. And after that, we kind of pop the stack and store the thread ID, the current thread ID, in the topmost stack element. Okay, and additionally, then the final step is to enqueue this thread ID into the ready queue. Okay? Yeah. So once again, so init stack places three elements into the new stack, namely the argument, the -1 for the frame pointer, and this weird code address F for termination. And that was all. And the creation of the thread then kind of creates a new thread ID, initializes the thread table, and enqueues the new thread into the ready queue, and then returns the thread ID. That's it. Okay, so now, since we have this, we have still this layout of the thread in mind, we may immediately think of what do we do when we want to terminate a thread. So, termination of a thread may return a value. Now, termination of a thread may return a value, and there are two ways of terminating a thread. So the first thing is, perhaps most obvious one, is that the initial function call is terminated, and then the return value is the return value of the call. So that means there really could be a value which is returned, and that is, and we know we have a dedicated place where to return it, namely in this where the argument in the argument cell. So that means in the bottommost element of the stack sits the return value of the thread, so that we can pass back to the adjoining thread. So that is one thing. Then the other thing is, there is a slightly more unusual way how to terminate a thread, and that is by calling the function exit. And that is kind of something like an exception, which can be raised by a thread, and then immediately the value handed over to the exit function is passed as a return value. Okay, this return value, so our kind of convention is that we pass that return value back to the to the outside world through the bottommost stack cell, and then that is one thing. And then the other thing is that for this exit thing, that this is like for an exception, this may occur arbitrarily deeply nested, and that means when this exit occurs, we have to kind of unwind the stack, have to throw away all the stack frames, and kind of to identify the bottom of our stack, to pass the value there. And this finding the bottom of the stack is in so far not completely obvious how to do it, because the memory is contiguous. It's just memory cells. So one stack sits perhaps besides the other, on top of another one, and so on. So how to detect the bottom element? But for that, one thing, what we can, the precaution which we have taken was that we marked the bottommost stack frame by the old FP equals minus one. And no other old FP will have a negative address. Every old frame pointer will have a positive address. So by this minus one, we identify, aha, here is the bottommost stack frame, and we have reached the end. So, but that also means we cannot directly jump to down here, so and pop the stack in one go, as we did for the exception. But we really have to go down one stack frame after the other. On the other hand, exit will not happen so often, so therefore we can afford that. Okay, and that's one thing. So now once we have kind of put the value down there, then we still have to do the real exit of the thread, and that means by we do this terminal treatment of threads, and for that we have this still this fabulous address F, which I have introduced, but I have not yet told you what will happen there. Okay, so here is now the code for this exit thing. So first we will have to evaluate the argument of the exit. Okay, then we have to go down, and we have no way to do so. So therefore, again, we take this ingenious way of calling this function exit. But additionally, I have also placed here two more instructions, which with fancy meaning. One thing is this exit, this term, and the other thing is this next. And we will immediately see what that means. So, but for the first, let us see at the topmost of this list of duties which we would like to implement. This is this exit thing. So exit, as I said, this should kind of successfully, hopefully, pop the stack frames. So that means it first has on top of the stack, it has the value this of the E. So this is this result thing, and that I kind of store away in this variable result. And then I just do the following while the frame pointer is different from minus one. I do the following. I put the stack pointer at frame pointer minus two. Frame pointer minus two is, that is below the organizational cells, then I set the frame pointer to the frame pointer points always to the continuation address, so this FP minus one is the old frame pointer. So in that sense, I go from one frame pointer to the next frame pointer. Yeah? And that I repeat until the frame pointer, the old frame pointer, which I extract from the stack frame, is minus one. And in that case situation, the SP here points to two elements below the frame pointer, which is where the return value has to be stored. And then I place the return value there, and that's it. By that, I kind of go down the stack frame. One more, perhaps, side remark. This, when one has exceptions at, so this going down the stack frame is also something which one would do for an exception in C++, for example. But then there you have to do more, because for every stack frame which you pop, you have to look at all the objects which are sitting there and call the destructors for all the objects. So there's a lot more work to do there. But here we have, luckily we have only C, and so this deallocation of a stack frame is much simpler. But so the noise kind of tells us we should finish for today. Thank you for your attention, and we continue tomorrow.